Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. For more information, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meat in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are broadcasting not from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but rather from the Emory Hotel in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And why am I here? Well, I'm here because there is something called the Women Chefs and Restaurateurs Conference going on at this very moment. And I was lucky enough to run into my old friend, Lauren Nishan. Lauren turns out to now be the vice president of operations for something called RTE Cuisine, and she has introduced me to Janet Holt. And did I say that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Janet is the founder and owner.
CEO.
And CEO mm-hmm. of RTE Cuisine. So, Janet, tell me, what is RTE Cuisine? Because it's super cool.
RTE Cuisine is, we manufacture ancient grains and seeds. They are fully cooked, shelf stable, and ready to eat for food service, non-commercial, commercial food service.
So when you say ancient grains and seeds, like, what are you talking about?
Seeds that are low gluten or gluten free and that have been out of the food cycle for a while, like spelt. Yes.
Yeah,
so
uh-huh.
The farro family includes spelt and emmer and einkorn. We use spelt.
Ooh, emmer. I hear about emmer a lot. Lots of people want to use emmer now. That's very cool. Einkorn, another crop that I've been reading about in various trade magazines.
They're sisters, spelt, einkorn, and emmer.
Uh-huh. And what is there something else besides that? Are these ancient grains? When you talk about ancient grains, are they gone? You can talk.
Yeah. So ancient grains, what it really refers back to, when you think about most wheat that we use in breads and pastas and such, it's been genetically modified, not genetically engineered by any means. Like, there's no Monsanto involvement.
It's been hybridized,
but truly it is modified from its original intent back when, you know, the plant itself was created to be what it is. Like farro, for example, I believe it's the emmer version, was used with Greek soldiers back in Roman mm-hmm. times, and that it was grown to be a taller, sturdier crop hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and it remains to be that same way today.
Mm-hmm. And they have high nutritional values, right?
Yeah, nutrient dense, and, you know, the benefits are the, you know, besides the nutrient dense piece, that they are lower gluten and or gluten free, which are just naturally more beneficial for our bodies.
Uh huh. And when did you found this company? How long has this been going on? How long have you been getting into trouble like this?
Well, RTE Cuisine has been a project for the last couple of years, and uh-huh. we officially started the business about a year and a half ago. And pulled the team together here, you know, in the last 6 months. And, you know, we're out of the gate strong and really excited to bring this fantastic product to the market. And
Nourish. Now, when you say this is cooked and ready to eat, you showed me the packaging. Mm-hmm. So just to give people an idea of what we're talking about, this is like a vacuum-sealed package of grains that have already been cooked, but you said it's shelf stable, so it doesn't have to, it does not require refrigeration.
Right, right. So the grains, you know, the pouch is, it's a special technology where the raw grain is put in the pouch with some salt, water, a little bit of safflower oil, and it's sealed and then cooked in the pouch. So it's special steam spray cooked, and then, you know, it has a 12-month shelf life. When you open the pouch up, then the grain, it's the first time the grain's exposed, so there's no evaporation. There's that's why it remains nutrient dense, and the flavor the flavor stays very stays intact, so it's very high quality flavor
profile. Now, how did you know to use this technology? What's your background that you knew that you could get away with this nifty little trick?
Well, this goes into the question you were going to ask next, I think, is just my background.
Don't reveal my secrets, Janet.
So I have them.
So you have a background in grains. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Describe that.
So born and raised in a farming ranching community in Southern Alberta. I've been around grains and my entire life, and have been in the food and agriculture industry for my entire career. And as a commodity trader or agri-trader, I was buying grains and or commodities and selling them to distribution companies and manufacturing companies. And throughout the years, relationships built, and oftentimes a further processor would call me and say, I've got extra product, can you go find a home for it in the market? So they would resell back to me this product, and then I would go sell it out into the market.
But you were mostly selling like corn and soy, right? I mean, you weren't exactly being a broker for Emmer and Einkorn, right?
No, true. But my mom, bless her heart, this is her baby, really. We were raised with grains in our diet every day, and she was a big grain advocate, kind of the inspiration behind this business project. And she was inspiring farmers long before organic was a thing to grow organic, and she had her own cookbook, her own cooking show, and she was just very
in Alberta.
Yeah, she was
wicked cool.
So I've been around the grains, know of them, and some of these are new as well. I'd never heard of teff, you know, until. But the last few years, I was working for a grain and flour milling company, and as I started seeing ancient grains, plant-based proteins starting to trend again, quinoa being the pioneer of that over the last 6 years, I was just, you know, keeping my eye on things. And when I, you know, as I started talking to the industry, especially chefs, understanding there was a problem, an opportunity to solve a problem in the kitchens with, you know, using grains because of the lack of stovetop space that you need for this type of application or format. And the ready-to-eat piece, the shelf-stable piece.
Right.
And the low culinary skill needed. So, you know, all the little stars aligned and the business came.
But so just to go back to, because as we were talking, you know, earlier in the day, Janet and I were sharing the fact that we both have ADD, meaning that it's very hard for us to stay on track with one question. So I, with that conversation firmly in mind, I want to go circle back to the technology that you describe in terms of creating this product, where it's boiled in the, essentially boiled in a vacuum sealed bag. Like, where did you learn about that? Did you do the research, or was it something that you learned about through your work as a commodity trader?
Yeah, it was as a commodity trader and networking and just relationships and understanding with the manufacturing side of the industry, what technologies were out there, what people were doing, and, you know, relationships, food shows, you know, you pick up and connect the pieces, and met a group that I felt had a very advanced technology, and they steam cooked it, which is better than boiling because the, you know, concept, because there's no evaporation with it. And it's a proprietary type of technology that really helps. It helps the grains stay intact.
So they retain their nutrient value.
Yeah.
Right. Much more so than
and texture
boiled.
As well. And consistently cooked throughout the pouch. Both consistently throughout the pouch and with every pouch that's being cooked at the same time in different areas of the machine.
Right.
So that's where, you know, the proprietary piece being so, like, this is the technology that we want to use is, like she was saying, when she built that relationship.
There's other technologies out there, but this was the most ideal. And it was mostly aligned with the way that I was taught to cook grains or that the way my mom cooked grains as well. And the texture piece, we had the, you know, our catchphrase was chef quality taste with shelf stable ease. But when Lauren came on board, we added the word based on her input, texture, chef quality taste and texture, because it was really a good observation that the texture was ideal too.
So you're not getting mushy.
Mushy or too al dente, where it's kind of like you're chewing on a nut and crunching in your mouth.
Yeah, where you're cracking a tooth on that bad boy.
Yeah, so pecans in here.
So, so you use heirloom grains. Where do you find enough of them? Because not that many people are growing einkorn, emmer. You have black lentils, I noticed as well, which is quite unusual in this country, especially.
Right.
How do you develop relationships with farmers to get them to grow this stuff? Or do you not need to have a relationship with a farmer and you can just go on to the market and find that?
Right. And I think part of it is just the network that, you know, I've spent, you know, a number of years in. You just kind of know where to go, where to look. Mm. And we try to source most all grains that we can domestically. Some come from Canada. And there are grains like quinoa that come from South America. So that is the source. Teff comes from Ethiopia. Although there are some growers here stateside that are growing teff. And as that growing supply increases, then we can, you know, we can start to use more of more domestic products as they come up. So we mix what we have to. The portfolio that we have in line, the grains that are chosen for that portfolio are specifically chosen to be able to scale. So if we use spelt because we know there's a really good supply of spelt out there.
Right.
Versus einkorn or emmer is less of a supply. And I know where to find spelt and good quality, you know, growers. So that's the choice that we have. Same thing with black lentils. We know where to buy lentils in supply so that if we don't run out.
Right.
And we, although we want to buy from boutique farmers and small family farms, you know, that's what primarily we would always choose first. We're not always able to do that.
Well, I was going to ask you about the, you know, what prompts the selections that you make and what the cost is, the cost differential is between buying something that's a bit more esoteric but might be kind of more exciting and interesting to the consumer as opposed to, you know, buying a more conventional grain like, I don't know, long grain brown rice or something, or Carolina gold rice or something like that.
Well, we have a nice diverse portfolio that have grains that are affordable and then more exotic expensive grains.
Oh, I see.
I.e. like Frika. Frika is a more expensive grain. It's an old wheat, and you know, it's green. It's kind of a green wheat that is, you know, say 3-4 times the price of spelt.
Right.
And spelt being another wheat, but so you have choices on both ends of the spectrum. And the same thing with quinoa. Quinoa being a gluten-free seed, we've got, you know, it's a higher price.
It is.
You know, it has a complete protein, or all 9 essential amino acids is the claim. And then you go to sorghum, which is another gluten-free seed, but it's less expensive. It's three or four times less expensive.
Well, sorghum is used in animal feed as well, right? Isn't that a pretty widely grown grain?
I'll get chastised if I bring up that.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, the cows have been eating good for a long time.
Yeah,
because sorghum is absolutely delicious and it's super underutilized. I almost would think that if people knew the secret to sorghum, that the price might jump. So shh.
it's not unlike the industry where, you know, you've got several grains that have been used for cattle feed or animal feed for decades, and now they're coming back into the, you know,
into the human side. Yeah.
So they've been around. They just haven't really been around on our...
Well, like I think about millet, for instance. I mean, I have a parakeet. So my parakeet loves millet. All parakeets love millet. And they get dried millet sprays, and that's a treat. But millet is a staple grain in Senegal, for example. Yeah. And they grow millions of acres of millet there, and it's really delicious. I love it. I've eaten it a lot.
It's incredibly delicious. We just had a meal at Chef J.J. Johnson's restaurant in New York City at the Henry.
Uh-huh.
And he had a millet dish on the side of this beef rib. It was incredible.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. There's the grains are they're fantastic. The flavor profiles, they have unique flavors, each of them, and I'm a big fan.
Yeah, well, you grew up with them, but I think, you know, the thing is that it's kind of like the way there's a group in Rhode Island, a young woman whose name, of course, eludes me, Sarah, I can't remember, but she started a group, an NGO called Eating with the Ecosystem, and the idea was to bring consumers to bring underutilized fish species to the consumer, because consumers are so trained to eat the things that the grocery stores tell us we're allowed to eat. I mean, essentially, you think we have a bajillion products in a grocery store, but actually we really don't compared to what's truly out there. But they have made those selections for us over the, you know, past 50, 60 years. And so now we have, you know, we're only eating, you know, flounder and salmon and halibut and, you know, whatever else, you know, sea trout, bass. And eating with the ecosystem, they encourage fishermen to bring into market things like sea robin or dog shark or, you know, stuff that is not as common on menus or in the grocery store. And you're essentially doing the same thing, the same, you know, you're creating the same market plan in a way for grains to get us weaned off of short and long grain, brown rice, white rice. And what is the other grain we eat?
Wheat.
Wheat.
Barley.
Well, but you know, people don't even really cook barley very often,
right?
Right.
I mean, it's really, you eat rice, you eat potatoes.
Well, and that's the secret sustainability of a product like ancient grains.
Right.
For example, like underutilized, like West Coast groundfish, for example. The population has bounced back after sustainability efforts. But, you know, it's difficult to fish for just one type of fish. When you're, you know, trawling the bottom of the ocean.
Yes.
So you have to find a way to market this fish that people, now it's been replaced by tilapia, but it's more sustainably harvested. And like with grains, our grains, for example, if you're looking at like a farro, it grows more in harmony with nature. It doesn't need as many inputs.
Right.
So you're not, you know, spraying, you know, with any glyphosate. You need minimal insecticide, if any at all. Actually,
right.
Several of our products are certified organic simply because you do not need to use any chemical inputs in order to
right.
grow.
So you're not lacing
a prolific
this, you're not putting tons
yield,
of fertilizer
yeah.
down in order
exactly.
to get a yield off of your acreage.
Exactly.
So just out of curiosity, what prompts you to make the selections that you made in your portfolio?
Well, diversity and you know, again, grains are a commodity, so we are victim to weather and you know, crops and crop rotations, etc. So we wanted to make sure that if we supply a grain, that we have substitute grains, alternative grains. For example, if someone's using a nice white gluten-free grain like or seed like quinoa, and something happens to the quinoa export business and they've, you know, they need a replacement for that, we can switch them to sorghum, which is another light white, you know, gluten-free grain and mild, you know. So we've tried to, you know, have a variety that can be interchanged with others, black lentils, chickpeas, and you know, another good example, black barley and
black barley.
Yeah.
That sounds kind of great.
Yeah,
I love
good.
Barley. It's one of my favorite grains.
You would love our super grain blend. It has black barley, daikon radish seed, frika, and farro. And the bite and the flavor of it by itself is outstanding.
Yeah.
You don't need to add anything
to it. One of our favorites.
Oh, that's great.
It's delicious.
A good hit for the infomercial there.
Yeah.
isn't really an infomercial,
so
but it is. But I
well, it's interesting because it's flavors, you know, that you don't really get that type of flavor or texture often. You don't get it when you certainly go to the grocery store, unless you're feeling very adventurous and you want to soak something overnight and figure out how to cook all those grains at the same time together well.
Yes. Yeah.
Or, you know, you can go to an obscure restaurant if you're lucky enough to live in a city where they have an ancient grain menu.
Yeah.
You know, it's very few and far between that you'd be able to have access.
Yes, I would say so. I mean, that's what actually made me so interested in your product when I met you. Was that it is a very unusual concept, and it seems like such a great idea to you know, introduce people to new grains, aside from the convenience for the chef or the restaurant industry. We're going to talk a little bit about what you're selling it into in a minute, but just kind of that idea of sort of diversifying the grain part of the plate so that we're not like, you know, it's kind of the same thing as not having just one breed of chicken or one breed of cattle, because you the opportunity for disease or some other disaster to wipe it out is a very real part of food security, right? So it's important to have the cultivation of these other strains of grains and pulses that people are going to become more accustomed to eating as we begin to phase animal proteins out of our diet, which unfortunately, as a meat eater, that's an unfortunate thing that's going to have to happen, but it is going to happen.
Well, and it's also the economical way to do it. And ancient grains and legumes, or seeds as we call them, you know, having a higher protein profile than your traditional wheat and corn, you can actually lower your plate cost, whether you're eating at home or at a restaurant in general, by replacing certain amount of ounces of meat with a grain, and you still are satiated and had a delicious eating experience, which is the delicious part. I mean, let's be real, that's a big part of it. As much as price, we're not going to pay dirt cheap for something that doesn't taste good unless we've been trained to like it. So.
Right. So let's take a quick break here for a sponsor drop.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. Did you know that every $1 invested in tourism marketing returns on average $3 to $8 back? Not a bad ROI. Learn how to grow your agritourism business via 12 workshops entirely women-led. The local travel landscape is rapidly changing to meet the demands of the leisure, event, and corporate travel sectors. Whether you're a farmer or producer, a winemaker, a restaurateur, or a destination marketing organization, there's more opportunity than ever to capture these markets. The Virtual Agritourism Conference will provide you with insights and skills to keep your target demographic coming back for more. 14 speakers providing 6+ hours of education that you can watch at your convenience anytime on any device. Maximize your time, budget, and resources, and focus on creative solutions to help your business thrive. Presented by Escape Maker and Fulton Stall Market, the full conference access pass is now available for purchase. Use the code HERITAGE2019 for $50 off a full pass at checkout. For more information and to purchase your pass, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
Are you enjoying this podcast?
Heritage Radio Network has plenty more.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Brandon Hoy.
And I'm Emily Pearson. Together we host The Main Course OG, where we cover food news and culture. Browse episodes of The Main Course OG wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
We're back with Janet Holt and Lauren Nishan from RTE Cuisine. We're talking about ancient grains and heirloom seeds. Not heirloom seeds. Heirloom grains and seeds. Heirloom grains.
Ancient grains. Ancient and heirloom, they're interchangeable. But we went with the ancient because it just really explains what these seeds are.
Yeah, it's a better marketing.
It is.
Yeah,
At least I thought so.
Come on. Yeah, let's face it. That's just better. So now you are selling this into... more into food service as opposed to into a consumer-facing entity like a grocery store. Why did you make that decision?
Well, we built the business model around the least resistance to market, and typically people go to retail first. On the retail shelf, there's there are fully cooked ancient grains. They call ancient grains, but it's brown rice and wild rice and maybe some quinoa.
Right.
But our portfolio is truly ancient grain based. It's not a rice based portfolio. It's a grain based portfolio, grain and seed based. And we do have brown rice as one of the options. But we wanting to get to market quicker. My experience and background is food service, more food service oriented.
Right.
So it naturally segued into that space. And I just am a big believer of getting, you know, I love the non-commercial food service space. I know the challenges of retail and slotting fees and, you know, just the
cost. Talk a little bit about that, because I want to, because you do know that, I want you to bring out for the listeners, like, you know, a lot of people think, like, just today, this afternoon, there we were at that wonderful, growing space that's in St. Paul, where they're, you know, it's going to be kind of a business incubator you know, business creator and a lot of food spaces in there. And we tasted all these different foods from different small manufacturers, and they were all geared towards getting into a grocery store. And I really wished that you had been on that panel so that you could talk about why that's not always the best path. So what makes it hard to get into a grocery store if you're a new, you know, if you're bringing a new product to market? You know, what's that process about?
Well, it takes a lot of money. So I have been bootstrapping, you know, bootstrapped this along for the most part. And so, you know, it logically made sense for me to first build a foundation in food service. And then we are going to eventually have a consumer-facing package, an 8-ounce or individual portion. But I still personally, no offense to retail, but trying to avoid that space. But we will, you know, we'll have an online store. We'll have a way for the consumer to access, you know, the grains outside of food service. But it's a good foundation to build upon. It's also, food service it's underserviced. And in particular, non-commercial food service. So there was a real opportunity in that market segment was starting to pick up and have interest in having whole grains on their menus at the hospital level, at the corporate cafe level, you know, B&I sectors. And so there was just an underserviced area that there was a clear opportunity for versus going into the retail, retail grocery store shelf, which is very highly competitive,
right.
Very expensive to get into. And
are you charged a fee? Are you charged? I mean, I've heard that you have to like give, you know, 3 cases. Like, say, I recently attended a workshop for farmers about getting their stuff put into grocery stores, local grocery stores. And there's like, well, you have to give the first 5 cases for nothing. And then, you know,
they want incentives. They want discounts that sometimes they receive and the consumer does not see.
Right.
Then they also want the consumer discounts. They want the marketing materials. And then you also for good business, have to market yourself to consumers.
Sure.
Minimum, I mean, for a very successful launch of a product, minimum, I would imagine, between at least $20,000 to $50,000 in a marketplace.
Yeah.
If you're really going to go full bore, and, you know, we're up against Ancient Harvest and others who have been out there, Seeds of Change, you know, the consumer has this product and there are very strong brand names on the shelf where our product would be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when it comes to chefs, I mean, when we were at the International Restaurant and Food Service Show of New York, chefs would have to ask us 2 or 3 times what exactly our product was, because they couldn't believe it. It's just such a foreign concept. And especially those who cook from scratch, they're like, you mean I don't have to cook farro for 2.5 hours?
Yesterday, they're like, what?
Yeah, they're like, wait, I don't understand. You know?
Right, right. All I have to do
really
is put it in the microwave and give, or throw it in a piece of, in a little bit of broth and give it whatever flavor I want to flavor it with or something like that,
and
right?
And the convenience, you know, for consumers, it makes sense because we're all constantly on the go, et cetera. But that's also why we go to restaurants, and not every restaurant has a kitchen that's built to spend the time or, you know, set up to have, you know, this going.
Multiple.
Like for operationally, for example, you would have to change, you know, your operations to get a menu cycle in with a grain that took 2.5 hours to cook.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And then cool.
That's the good business model side, you know, but personally, my inspiration was to get the grains to market and based on a lot of my childhood experience, porridge is one of my favorite items that we have produced, a 10 grain porridge. And it was so that youth could enjoy whole healthy grains without, throwing it back up in your bowl like I used to when I was little.
Let's just say mom's porridge wasn't as good as our porridge.
I see.
Which is why our porridge is so good. Janet was committed to making a really delicious porridge after having that experience.
And committed to getting this too. And then I went to college. I have young adult children, and I wanted to get healthy grains in front of them at college. We did a lot of testing on college-age kids with these grains.
Did you?
And they love them and the convenience of them, and it really works into the lifestyle. So
we're
excited to get, to take these grains to the consumer level once we develop a little bit of a foundation here in the food service space.
Right. Well, I love the idea of them going into a college space. And I think that colleges, I know my daughter went to UMass for a couple of years, and Ken Tung, who is the, you know, the food service director there, serving 45,000 meals a day, people,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like huge.
And he has worked so hard to develop menu concepts that really are truly healthful. And by doing so, he's actually educating a whole new generation of kids about what good food is. And it can still be a hamburger or a piece of fried chicken. It's just not out of a Kentucky Fried bucket or a McDonald's, you know, griddle. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's something a little, you know, he buys slightly quite a lot better quality, you know, and it's prepared in a way that is more healthful, et cetera, et cetera. And I know grains were a real big interest of his, for the, and probably for the very reason that we've just been discussing. It's a healthy alternative to so many other things like French fries or whatever, you know?
Well, you think about too, and when you get into a large, healthcare, you know, further education, higher education, K through 12, or those institutional settings where they have budgets and you have to be careful of cost. Grains are a much less expensive protein source than, let's say, and I'm a big meat eater. I love beef, chicken, pork, everything.
We do. We are.
But
yeah,
I'm a big advocate. But is it
fits very well? Carrion carnivore.
It fits well into their business models because it's an affordable protein to have on the menu.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Healthcare is a great application, but also in the school systems because, you know, as I think most of us know at this point, most schools, public schools, had their kitchens essentially dismantled, starting around the Reagan era. I like to blame everything on Reagan and Thatcher. I'm just going to tell you right now, that's my politics. But I think they were the end of the world as we know it now. But in any case, these school systems do not have the funding to restore kitchens without tremendous intervention from either parents or something else, some grants or something. And so this is a perfect application for them. It's already cooked. It's in its steam-proof, waterproof, heat-proof package. Throw that baby into the steam table. Bob's your uncle, man.
Yeah, because they're used to using a can opener for almost everything
absolutely.
That was once fresh.
Right.
And something like a farro or a freaka or a super grain or even rice does not come canned.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't come, normally it doesn't come cooked either.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So, and since what you've got in a school kitchen typically is either a steam kettle or deck ovens and a fryolator.
The steam kettles are expensive.
Yeah, you're lucky if you have a steam kettle, right?
Yes,
but this you
could
just put into a steam table. Open up the pouch and put it in a steam table.
Yeah.
And it's hot by lunchtime.
You can heat it in the pouch, either, you know, steam, boil it on the stovetop or microwave.
Right.
So it could be heated in the pouch, so you don't have to put it in
the pouch, stir into whatever your recipe is, voila.
Right.
Bake it if you want to.
It's like you would take the black lentils, one of my favorite that Mark put together was tomato soup, and then just pour black lentils into the soup, stir it, and then you have this, you know, delicious bite texture in the soup, and it's got protein.
And a big protein.
Yeah, right.
And what could be better for hungry little bodies and minds that need to focus
delicious.
In their classrooms.
Yes.
I love it. Okay, so listen, let me tell me this. What is your competition? You mentioned the two companies that already have shelf space in the grocery stores, but in terms of working in a bigger arena like healthcare or education, Who? Anybody else doing this, or are you guys all on your own?
We believe we're first to market. There's a handful of market manufacturers that have this technology, but most of them are geared toward CPG,
individuals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're our competition really is cooking from scratch.
Yeah.
And if we had a competition, it would be trying to find the right kitchens and chefs that want to spend their time and culinary talent on maybe COP items or other more, you know, other items that take more creativity. And
what's COP?
Center of the plate.
Sorry, thank you.
Which we just want to make sure that
everybody knows what we're talking about.
Yeah. And so cooking from scratch is our competition, essentially.
Uh-huh. And how have you managed, how have you addressed, or are you at the point yet now where you have to find distributors who are willing to distribute your product? Like, how are you marketing this aside from having the extraordinary Laura Nishan, you know, work the wires for you?
GPA GSD right here.
Yeah, that's right. GPA GSD.
Yeah.
We won't spell out.
We won't
that
spell acronym. It out. You can, yeah. But I mean, how are you approaching that problem of distribution? Because
it's always a bottleneck, and it's been, you know, a work in progress. Before I even started the company, it was conversations with broadline, distributors as well.
All
as
two local. Of them.
Yeah. Right.
Cisco and US Foods.
Yeah.
Right.
But you know, it's always, you know, this is the cart before the horse, and it's always a bottleneck, and we're at that point, and expectedly we have 10 SKUs set up with Cisco, and now it's about working the individual opcos and introducing the product, and it's still a whole nother sales cycle to get it into the individual opcos. But as we, you know, as we build our customer base, and you know, it's pull through, right? So customers are requesting it, then the opco houses are going to bring it in.
And by opco, she means
Cisco operating company. They're all called opcos. Yeah, right. They're like the different.
They're distribution centers.
Right.
And it's interesting because, you know, even having something set up with a distributor, any distributor really, they want customers to bring that product in to order pallets and cases of product.
Right.
But then you go to the customers and they're like, "Yes, I want this now." And you say, "Okay, well, luckily we direct ship." But it's difficult with the distributors because we then need to have those customers who then were not at their distributor. So it's kind of a limbo.
Yeah.
It's cart before the horse. It's more like two horses, you know,
right, not yet harnessed.
Each other.
Two horses that are not
running
yet
in a circle. Yes, exactly.
Together.
Running in a
They're
circle.
Not in the
wild.
Same yoke.
We're just going to face the same direction right now.
And we're a small team. You know, we are a startup. We have a team of four right now, concentrated, and we're bringing on more people to support with sales.
Uh-huh.
But we're a small team, so we all try to wear that hat of getting out there. Janet's been traveling a lot. We both have been traveling a lot. And Mark, our other teammate, just getting out there and evangelizing and making sure that customers know, hey, we can start you up direct ship from us. And then when we get to a point, we will be able to come into that distribution chain.
Right, into that space.
Yeah.
So what's the best lesson you can offer? Because we got to wrap this up. But what is the best lesson or piece of advice you have for entrepreneurs? Since you've obviously started, this is not your first time at the rodeo, right, to coin that cliche.
Started her first business at 18.
Yeah. What's your best advice for somebody who wants to start something like this, any kind of food business?
I would say make sure that it's something you're passionate about, you get behind, and, you know, wait for the right opportunity. A lot of times I think, you know, if all the stars aren't aligned and people settle for half the stars, it's more difficult to succeed. So make sure all the stars are aligned.
Yeah, but it takes, I think you could also safely say, Janet, that it takes a lifetime of experience to recognize when those stars are aligned.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lifetime of connections, which you have made through all of the different hats that you've worn as a commodity trader, as a other, you know, entrepreneurial adventures that you've been on. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a pretty impressive story, I have to say. I'm really into it, and I will follow it with great interest. I really hope the best for you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, for my darling Lauren here, who's going to, I know, rock the world with this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
I work for Janet for a reason. We have a lot of fun together, and we get, you know, the job done, and with a smile. Mm-hmm.
That's great. And a shot of tequila.
And a shot of tequila.
Some people don't when they make
a sale. It's the secret. That's the secret to a good business, y'all, is having a bottle of tequila at the office for happy hour.
That's right. All right. Well, thank you both very, very much for joining me today. This has been great. It's been so much fun palling around with
you
here in Minneapolis.
Us.
Yeah.
And, you know, come back in 6 months. We'll talk about where you are in the next step of the process, right?
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Could be interesting.
Thank you, Katie.
You're
thank
very
you,
welcome.
Katie.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.